Around noon, Christy Roth started feeling well enough to struggle out of her bunk and walked up to the deck. Most of the passengers had recovered sufficiently to come out along with her. They sat and stood in singles and small groups, subdued, drained, weary after the night of storms. They squinted in the bright sunshine, clearly out of their element. Christy picked Jack and Doc out of the crowd but made no eye contact with them. Until they reached their destination, the other companions were to be treated as strangers. Christy stepped up beside Mildred, who stood at the port rail amidships.
How far have we come?
Not very. Maybe 100 miles or so. We had the sails down most of the night, going nowhere but up and down, up and down.
Where are we?
If Point Conception still existed, we would be grounded on the rocks right about now.
Point Conception?
Yeah. All the tales about the southern half of California falling into the sea are true. That ragged line of purple above the haze is what's left of the Sierra Madre. They used to be 50 or 60 miles inland from the coast. The Pacific's lapping on their flanks now. So far, it looks like everything south of Morro Bay is history. My guess is that the Soviets pounded the San Andreas Fault well to the east of Los Angeles with Earthshaker warheads. Deep surface detonations caused the fault to shift cataclysmically along its entire length, and the western plate sheared clean away. We're talking maybe 350 miles of coast underwater.
As Christy stared toward land, she could see scattered pillars of smoke rising from the surface of the glassy sea. In some places, it was white and opaque like steam. In others, it was black and dense, like oil fire smoke. The steady onshore breeze was blowing it away from them in seemingly endless low plumes to the distant mountains. Even so, the air smelled faintly of rotten eggs and brimstone.
How far did it all sink?
No telling how deep the water is between here and those mountains. Deep enough to submerge all signs of human habitation, for sure. It's like no one ever lived here.
What's burning on the sea?
It's not really burning. Those clouds are from volcanic vents and fumaroles. The white steamers are on the seafloor. The black smokers are on seamounts just under the surface. They must have opened up along the fault and deep fracture lines post-cataclysm. The clouds are created when cool seawater makes contact with superheated gases and molten lava. Some of it's bound to be highly corrosive, full of concentrated sulfuric and nitric acid. Get a lung full of that stuff, and presto, no more lungs.
Wow. Good thing the wind is pushing it away from us.
Scanning the sea, Christy saw a mature tree floating about 75 yards away, presumably uprooted whole and blown into the ocean by the chem storm. Branches and leaves trembling, it moved along with them. Then, apparently of its own accord, it abruptly reversed direction.
What in the red blazes?
Christy grabbed the cables and climbed up on the gunwale for a better look. Mildred scrambled up alongside her. The oak tree glided in a foaming circle, picking up speed as it spiraled inward toward a shifting dark core, a black hole. Christy could see the tree wasn't alone. Other debris was caught in the powerful current. White plastic bags, plastic bottles, coils of seaweed, bits of paper, a half sheet of plywood. Aang brought the rudder hard over as Christy saw a line of similar whirlpools that stretched on for miles, paralleling the redefined coast. The floating garbage had no chance. Swirling funnels of black inexorably drew everything to their centers. Some of the vortexes were big enough to pull down house trailers or sailing ships. Captain Aang gave the whirlpools plenty of room, steering for the low island. His course set, Aang pulled a wad of white cotton batting from his pants pocket, tore off a couple of sizable hunks, and thumbed them up his wide nostrils. The rest of the crew was following suit, plugging their noses with cotton wads. This done, they began passing up plugs to the male passengers.
Hey, what's that for?
Not for you.
Hey, now, if there's danger, we want some too.
No danger for you. You're safe. So is she.
Well, I'd like...
Forget it. If there's some kind of poison in the air, nose plugs made of cotton aren't going to help us anyway. Look around. Nobody's covering their mouth. It makes no sense. Breathing toxics or corrosives through your mouth will get you just as dead as breathing them in through your nose.
But if it isn't poison or acid, then what is it?
Your guess is as good as mine.
So what do you suggest?
I suggest we wait and see how it plays out.
Up near the bow, Ryan was accepting a pair of nose plugs from a crewman. Avoiding the suckhole obstacle course brought the ship to within 100 yards of the island's shore. Closer in, deep blue water shoaled to a light turquoise color. The island's summit was a rounded low mound of sun-blasted rock and dirt. Below an eroded bluff, a broad, shallow cove was fronted by a narrow beach. Along the base of the cliff stood four crude stone huts with no glass in the windows and no doors.
I can't tell which island it is. There's so little left of it. It has to be one of the bigger ones, though, either Santa Cruz or Santa Rosa.
The breeze sweeping across the island carried the scent of perfume, although there was no evidence of flowering plants. Indeed, no evidence of plants of any kind. The scent got stronger and stronger.
Ugh, what's that smell? It's like rotting fruit.
Oh, I know. There's somebody on the shore.
Christy squinted and saw white human forms eerily rising from the stones of the beach. Four beautiful young naked women beckoned languidly, invitingly, holding out what looked like plates heaped with food and pitchers of drink. The male passengers along the rail were drop-jaw riveted by the sight. Some were obviously pitching trouser tents.
Ugh, men can be such triple stoops.
It's not their fault. There must be something in the perfume.
It's not doing anything for me.
Me either.
The islanders seem unaffected, too. Maybe because they know what to expect or how to fight it. That scent must contain pheromones, chemicals that selectively stimulate the male of the species. Look around. Our fellow passengers are getting turned on despite the nose plugs. Damn it, that island's giving off aerosolized Spanish fly.
The crew stepped in before things got way out of hand. They shoved the dazed men to the starboard side of the ship and forced them at gunpoint to look the other way.
Hey, what's the deal with those women?
Arorongi. Not what they seem. Look.
The man offered a telescope. When Christy looked through the lens, she saw that the lovely faces were not faces at all. Blotches of dark pigment formed seductively lashed eyes and smiling mouths. They had discernible heads, necks, breasts, waists, and hips, but only from a distance. Up close, they were just white oblong shapes, ingeniously shaded to look human. Their long flowing hair was made up of frantically waving filaments, like the tendrils of albino sea anemones. The plates of food held colored rocks. The jugs were empty.
Not real wahinis. Set foot on the beach, you find that out quick. Looks like four, but there's only one. There are fingers on a hand that hides beneath the sand and rocks. Hand is evil. Its smell is sweet and loving, but it eats mean. Sucks the blood and marrow from their bones.
Christy turned toward the splashes to see two men frantically swimming for the island.
Nobody else think about jumping!
All the passengers lined up along the stern, watching the deserters grow smaller and smaller, still swimming with great determination toward the alien and deadly shore. The ship sailed on, turning southeast, and the cove slipped out of sight. By the time the swimmers reached the beach, they were too far away for their screams to be heard. Gradually, the males recovered their senses. Driven by a steady 12-knot wind, the ship plowed on. The fore-and-aft rocking motion was soothing, even stupefying after the sleepless night. Christy dozed for hours in the warm sun. When she awoke, Mildred was by her side, watching over her. Christy rose from the deck and took in an even more dismal vista.
That's where Los Angeles used to be.
It looked positively primeval. Plumes of molten lava and caustic smoke jetted from the black tips of emerging seamounts. Scattered lakes of flame danced on the surface from petrochemicals that had oozed up from the bottom. On the land, volcanic cones thousands of feet tall spewed ash clouds, creating a low ceiling of gray that blocked out the blue sky to the east. Everything in that direction was tinged with yellow, smoke-filtered light. The bases of the Sierra Nevada in the distance were barely visible for the haze of sulfur and particulate matter.
It's a graveyard for as far as you can see. Millions of people died there on Nuke Day. There used to be a central core of skyscrapers and gridwork streets filling the Great Basin, edge to edge, stretching to the desert in the east. Whatever the fireballs and nuke blasts left behind, geologic forces have toppled and buried. Los Angeles has been scraped clean of everything human and everything made by human hands.
What about the radiation? Is the place poisoned?
Definitely. See anything flying over it? Anything swimming in it?
What about us? Aren't we too close?
Moot point, I'm afraid. What few extra rads we might pick up in passing aren't going to make us ill. The eruptions are the real problem. They've been sending radioactive material aloft into the upper atmosphere for more than a century. All that stuff has to come down somewhere. In fact, it comes down everywhere.
We've been breathing it and eating it all of our lives. But none of us are sick, though.
Short of a massive dose of gamma rays, radiation doesn't kill its victims quickly. It can take decades for the damage from lesser levels of exposure to show up as cancer. Even folks with terrible superficial burns sometimes recover. White coats found that out after Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Chernobyl. It's a matter of genetic luck and total rad exposure. Most people in Deathlands don't live long enough for the sickness to ever show up. They get chilled by other things first.
Look at that!
Christie pointed at a sudden commotion on the surface. About 150 yards from the ship and 5 miles off the hellish, uninhabitable coast, it was definitely not volcanic. A huge living creature thrashed and rolled up there. It was at least 30 feet long and splashing fountains of water tinged with gallons of blood.
It's a whale! And it's under attack!
Only when the animal stopped thrashing could Christie see it clearly. The barnacle-covered skin along its flanks was torn to shreds, torn through the thick white layer of blubber. Gory pits gnawed into the dark purple meat. Though the whale floated quietly, gathering the last of its strength, the surface around it churned and humped. There were things in the bright red water, much smaller creatures, streaking pale, people-sized shapes. They were tearing at it from underneath. Hundreds of them.
More sail! We move! Now!
What the hell? What are those things?
I hope we don't have to find out.
When supper time came, Christie and Mildred joined the others assigned to the second feeding shift. The galley's tabletops were covered with a slick film of fried fish oil and littered with discarded squid beaks and shrimp shells. Christie had to take off her coat to keep from getting the mess on the long fur. After a day to recover, she found that her appetite had returned with a vengeance. Ignoring the gut-bomb sensation that came from swallowing cupfuls of grease, she chewed the golden, crispy bits.
What's the bell for? What's going on?
I don't know, but it can't be good. Let's join them.
Above the deck, the wind was dying down. The sea was a polished mirror. Off the bow, framed by a sunset of orange and salmon pink reflecting off the smooth water, with blood-red underlighting the tiers of volcanic clouds to the east, lay a ship slightly smaller than their own, painted black and brown. Instead of three masts, it had two, each rigged for four sets of sails. It was adrift, riding low as if overloaded or in the process of sinking. Its canvas was torn and hanging in strips, its cables broken, trailing in the water. Nothing moved on deck. A few oil lamps glowed weakly. All the others were extinguished. It looked like they had been burning since the night before. Captain Aang cut a wide, cautious circle around the vessel, then began to spiral closer. Every time he turned downwind, an awful stench engulfed them. The stench of death. When they got a little closer, Christie could see the wreck was a wooden ship, a coastal cargo trader like theirs. Overlapping planks formed the hull. There were holes in it above the waterline. Dozens of them. They didn't look like damage from cannon shot. Their edges were ripped out, not blown in. The holes were big enough for a person to crawl through.
Oh, Gaia.
Tell me about it. This cannot be good.
Islanders scurried to pull in the sails. The white ship glided to a stop, upwind of the derelict vessel and its pall of death. Ryan was a short distance away from the two women, and from his vantage point he could see the main deck. It was a wreck. Cables, ropes, and chains lay in tangled heaps. Tool chests and work tables were overturned. Some of the top deck cargo had come loose from its safety netting. Huge bags of grain had broken and spilled. Up close, Ryan could see marks where the black paint had been pulled off. Masses of overlapping tiny circles that exposed the bare wood beneath. The marks led directly from the waterline to the ragged hull breaches. Paths of popped paint. They weren't made by bullet impacts or grappling hooks or ball-peen hammers. Something had climbed up from the sea, up the side of the ship in great numbers, and once there, had gnawed and ripped through the inches-thick hull planks. All the bullet holes were on the main deck. The gunwales, the superstructure, and the masts were absolutely riddled. The scuppers gleamed with a litter of spent brass. Certainly thousands, maybe tens of thousands of rounds had been fired. Apparently to no avail. In broad swatches, congealed blood glazed the deck like purple varnish. Along the Tanawatia's rail, crewmen took positions with their Kalashnikovs and rocket-propelled grenades, ready to put up covering fire for the longboat that was lowered into the water on the port side. Sunset, like a second Armageddon, lit the ruined ship and the rapidly moving longboat. As six rowers pulled hard, a seventh islander stood braced in the bow, his AK shouldered and armed. No targets appeared. Nothing stirred on the opposite deck. Shipping their oars, the rowers tethered the longboat to the side of the brigantine. Ryan watched as the boarding party deftly scrambled up the broken lines and cables onto the main deck. Once there, they fanned out with assault rifles, sweeping the area, kicking over anything that could hide an attacker, quickly confirming there were no signs of life or death. The boarders then split up, entering the fore and aft companionways in a simultaneous rush. After a few minutes below decks, the crewmen spilled back into view and immediately lurched to the rail. One of the boarders raised his head and drew a forefinger across the front of his throat. Ryan glanced back at Captain Eng. Tear tracks ran down his scarified cheeks. Blood trickled over and off his broad chin, dripping upon his chest. He had sunk his sharpened teeth into his lip. A quiver of shock ran through the White Frigate's crew. The boarders hastily departed the death ship. They didn't pause to rifle the cargo on the main deck, which seemed strange to Ryan, as it was there for the taking, and in great quantities. They climbed back onto the Tanawatia, seven hard men, shaken to the core by what they had seen. The bow rider stepped up to the captain, reached out a trembling hand, and carefully placed a half-dozen gold rings on his palm. Rings of great weight, fashioned to fit huge fingers, like his, and clutched them in a white-knuckled fist. Ryan saw the captain mouth a quiet command. The crew around him immediately started running to reset the sails. The islanders were abandoning their dead. Only now there was barely enough wind to put the iron ship in motion. It crept slowly south for about 20 minutes. Then the wind died off altogether. They hadn't sailed far. Ryan could still see the silhouette of the derelict on the horizon, backlit in crimson. Aang stepped forward, the megaphone in his hands. It looked like the man had aged 10 years in the last half hour.
Orange! Death swims these waters. It is closer than you can imagine. It will find us long before dawn. Without wind, we cannot sail away to safety. Without wind, we must stand and fight.
Fight what?
Ryan turned and saw Jack Lauren, arms folded, a defiant scowl on his white face, his ruby-red eyes glittering with menace.
The Tower! This is our name for them. Things that swim and crawl. Things that climb and leap. Broad-tailed, slime-covered things. The Tower roam the southern seashelf in great schools, killing and eating every creature they find. These are no triple-stoop, pea-brained fishes. They are organized, like a war party. Some among us believe they were once human. They breathe the air like porpoises through the tops of their heads. They talk to each other underwater. They swim faster than the fastest sailing ship. They chill with their razor teeth and the suckers on their hands and feet. They eat only flesh. The fresher, the better. Last night, the Tower slaughtered and ate my cousin, Karetu, and his crew. They pulled his ship apart to get at him. For islanders, revenge is a duty and a pleasure. The creatures who have stolen our blood shall give their blood in buckets. This ship is not as easy to break into as Coretto's. When the Tower come to chill us, we will face them and take their lives. You Parangi are welcome to stand and fight at our side. Those who are too afraid to fight the Tower should go below decks. Don't block the stairways. Get in your bunks. Hide under your mattresses and pray for dawn.
And if the things get inside the ship?
Tower can't rip through iron, little Karako. But they will wear out their teeth and sucker hands trying. We will take our bloody vengeance on them, then pull back from battle. Below the metal decks, we are safe. They can't sink this ship. They must eat to live. They will move on by daybreak in search of easier meals.
Only a couple of passengers decided to go below and wait out the conflict. To the rest, it sounded like big fun, like shooting fish in a barrel, despite the fact that Aang had said these foes were nothing like fish. They assembled some of Deathland's, began checking their weapons. Ryan carefully set the Steyr butt first in a lidless plastic drum, leaning the forestock against the rim. This wasn't going to be a long-range battle. It was going to be nose-to-nose, or perhaps nose-to-blowhole. He unholstered his Sig Sauer and racked the slide back a half inch, making sure the chamber held a live round. After checking his front pockets for spare full magazines, he tested the release of his 18-inch Ponga knife from its leg sheath. It came out of the scabbard like it was spring-loaded. When he looked up, the sky had changed from red to lavender. Out on the placid sea in the distance, Ryan saw scattered disturbances, boils, rings, bubbles, signifying movements just beneath the surface. He couldn't tell what was making them, only that whatever it was big and plentiful. From covered storage bins along the rails, islanders hauled out dozens of the oil lamps, which they fired up and hung from the ends of long metal poles. At intervals around the perimeter, they extended the poles over the gunwales and lashed them in place, illuminating a broad stretch of the surrounding water as darkness closed on the drifting ship. Ryan moved to a corner of the stern, beside one of the racks of red 55-gallon barrels. The Tawa were coming, no doubt about that. Even without the boils and splashes, he could feel them, like a pressure building on all sides and from beneath. Without the wind, the night was very warm, humid. Ryan wiped the sweat from his gun hand onto his pant leg and leaned over the stern rail, straining to see deeper into the dark. Blood and air suddenly upwelled below him, a great undersea belch. The coppery stench it gave off made his throat slam shut. Then he saw them, about 15 feet down. Squirming pale bodies, bodies thick in cross-section. So many of them it looked like the sea floor had risen up. Though individuals were difficult to make out, the general body shape reminded Ryan of mud puppies or salamanders, only grown to full human size. They had short, muscular arms and legs folded and tucked tight to their torsos, and wide, powerful tails close to half of their overall length. The shoal of Tawa was visible, churning to the very edge of the light, and presumably well beyond. There was no telling how deep or how far it went. There were too many. Ryan adjusted his grip on the SIG. More than they had bullets for. Ryan checked the positions of his battlemates. Christy and Mildred stood amidships on the port side, Jack and JB along the opposite rail. Dot was near the forward companionway, just short of the bow. All had weapons drawn. Their fighting circle was stretched as far as it could get. If the battle went badly, if the Tawa broke through the human ranks, the companions would contract the ring, drawing in until they were fighting back to back. A slick pale head surfaced 20 feet off the stern. It blinked dead black eyes at Ryan.
Impossible. Stickies don't swim.
The thing was hairless, earless, and lipless. Stickies had no noses, just nostril holes in their flat faces. This creature had a snout, but no nostrils. Over the snout and splayed across the cheeks were four parallel folds of excess skin. Permanent deep wrinkles. Row upon row of needle teeth lined its gaping jaws. Jaws that twisted up at the corners in an exuberant, expectant grin. Ryan realized with a jolt that he recognized the face. It was the same one Captain Aang wore. Sharpened teeth, corrugated brandings, insane red-hot poker-sculpted smile, a crude replica mask of the sea beast, executed in human flesh and bone. The Tawa ducked as 7.62mm rounds hammered the water to a fine froth.
Hold your fire!
The islander holding the AK looked back at his skipper, then sheepishly looked down. Seeing what they were up against, a few more passengers decided to return to their bunks. Most of the rest looked torn between following their suddenly sleepy comrades and fighting the Tawa, but a few of the more lunatic mercies leaned over the gunwales, aiming their weapons at the water, hoping that another slick head would pop up. From the edge of the light, Ryan saw a V-wake shooting toward the middle of the hull. Beneath it, a streaking oblong shape. It looked like a beige torpedo homing in for the kill.
Get back!
The charging Tawa exploded from the water. Using the power of its tail and its surging forward momentum, it leapt high in the air. At the peak of its arc, it was 5 feet above the gunwale. For an instant, it looked like it was trying to jump onto the deck. Then it dropped, crashing its full weight onto the back of an outstretched and momentarily frozen Mercy. It landed with its five-fingered sucker hands latched onto the seat of its victim's pants and the base of its tail draped over the man's head. The tail's tip had transverse lobes, like the flukes of a porpoise or whale. A ridge of hard knobs rose up under the skin along the middle of its back, like cornrows of tumors, the result of a head-to-tail muscular contraction. Before anyone could get off a clear shot or otherwise come to the Mercy's aid, he was pulled headfirst over the side. The Mercy never came up for air, but almost immediately bits of him began to surface. Blood billowed and bubbled from the depths. Swirling in it were tiny shreds of flesh and sinew.
Back! They're coming!
And come they did. But instead of launching themselves over the rails and onto the deck, something the Talwar were clearly capable of doing, they threw their bodies against the sides of the ship. More and more of the creatures jumped from the water to the hull, clinging there with sucker hands and feet. The Talwar couldn't tear through the riveted iron plate, but their shifting, rapidly building weight made the vessel sway alarmingly from side to side. Steadying themselves on whatever came to hand, the passengers and crew pulled back farther, to the middle of the sloping deck, and closed ranks. Some knelt, some stood, as they faced the gunwales with raised, cocked weapons. Wave after wave of the creatures struck the ship. The sea seemed to get closer, and Ryan realized what was happening. The Tala's main force was crawling from the water, crawling over the backs and heads of those that had attached themselves to the hull. The combined weight of this oncoming living mass was pulling the ship lower, bringing the main deck 4 or 5 feet closer to the sea. The sheer number of bodies required was mind-boggling. Ryan wasn't alone in his sudden realization. A handful of passengers bolted for the companionway and the relative safety of their bunks. Everyone else seemed frozen in place, unable or unwilling to turn their backs on what was about to happen. Only when the Talwa's 360-degree launch platform was complete did they attack en masse. Upon some silent signal from all sides at once, the Talwa leapt from the shoulders and backs of their hull-stuck fellows, bounding over the gunwales.
Fire!
Multiple gunshot impacts hurled decapitated Talwa bodies and whipsawed torsos backward and overboard. Ryan keyholed his focus dead ahead, over the SIG sights. Fighting targets was no problem. He ripped off headshots one after another, as fast as he could pull the trigger. Instantaneous, skull-shattering kills. In less than 15 seconds of fire, the SIG slide rocked back, ejection ports smoking. Another rush of Talwa leapt onto the deck, stumbling over their fallen, soaking up auto-fire. Even the mortally wounded, the blinded, the gutshot, somehow found the strength to press forward into the teeth of the withering fusillade and certain destruction. In 5 seconds, 100 died, their blowholes spouting blood, then another 100, and another. Already their spilled gore flowed like syrup into the scuppers. Ravening, repeated bullet impacts aerosolized their flesh into a pink mist that incited the creatures that jumped through it to an even greater frenzy. Ryan raised the SIG and snap-fired into the gaping, teeth-lined black maw of an oncoming Talwa. He stepped aside, letting the suddenly brain-freed body hurtle past him, fountaining red from its blowhole. Other shooters dropped out of the fray to reload, creating gaps and cracks in the perimeter that allowed some Talwa to leap to the cables and up into the rigging. At the upper limit of the deck lamp's light, through the haze of gun smoke, they jumped back and forth from mast to mast like crazed flying squirrels. Ryan ignored them, methodically taking out the closest targets to hand, clearing the deck in front of him. Damn it! With no wind to drive it away, the gun smoke around the knot of human fighters grew thicker and thicker. It became hard to breathe, and hard to pick out fresh targets as they cleared the rails, which meant the Talwa were dying at arm's length. Blood mist coated Ryan's hands, face, and hair. He backhanded it from his one good eye. A kneeling passenger to Ryan's right had had enough, and stood too quickly. The man right behind him was already tightening down on his scattergun's trigger. The plume of brains and skull fragments splattered across an upcoming Talwa's chest. In the midst of battle, unable to stifle the urge, it paused to lick. And was eviscerated by crisscrossing AK fire. The scattergunner broke his single-shot weapon and thumped another high-brass shell into the chamber. Before he could snap the breech closed, he was set upon. The mutie clamped sucker hands on his face, then ripped it off like a tea towel. The man stood there, flat-footed, eyes bugging out through a white mask of shock, a white mask oozing pinpoints of red, watching as the Talwa fisted the face into its mouth. The creature juked suddenly sideways, blown off its feet and onto the deck by half a dozen weapons. It was still chewing the face as it died. Another Talwa went for the mutilated man, darting in a blur left to right. The creature grabbed him and jumped over the side of the boat. If Ryan sensed impending disaster, the sea beasts sensed looming victory. They threw themselves even harder into the fray, and arm's-length battle became hand-to-hand. Men were being pulled out of the firing line and into the cloud of burned cordite and black powder. Not just passengers, either. An Islander mate, easily 300 pounds of him, was hauled backward by the braided ponytail into the pall. For a horrible instant, he reappeared from the smoke. It looked like he'd been run over by a 10-ton wag. His right arm was torn off at the shoulder, and divots of flesh were missing from his face and bare chest. Sucker hands yanked him off his feet, and he was gone.
Enough! Pull back!
Ryan did a quick head check, making sure his friends had closed ranks. They had. Like him, they were misted with blood and peppered with a grid of gunshot residue. Ryan stood his ground at the entrance to the forecastle's companionway, putting up covering fire for the mass retreat, until an Islander shouldered him through the doorway. Ryan was shoved ahead, down the steep stairs to the crowded, low-ceilinged galley. He saw Doc, swordstick brandished, flailing ahead of him in the crowd.
By the three Kennedys!
The Tawa hurled their bodies against the bolted hatch, trying to batter it down.
What the hell is that?
The deck plates! They're pulling them up!
The rows of fasteners were all that secured the iron plates overhead. Many of the flush-mounted rivets had been jarred and vibrated up from their sockets by the Tawa's initial hull-pounding onslaught, which gave the attackers sucker purchase along the edges of the tight-fitting plates. 100 guns aimed point-blank at widening gaps in the ceiling.
No! Put your blasters away! I don't want any blast of fire from you below decks. You'll end up chilling all of us with the ricochets and misses. Leave the shooting to my crew. They know what they're doing. If the tower get in here, use your blades on them.
Suddenly, there were 5 or 6 simultaneous breaches, and not in the obvious places where the plates were visibly being rocked up and down. Using the pry bars, chisels, shovel blades they had found on the deck, the Tawa had carefully levered loose entire rows of rivets, freeing some of the plates on all sides, plates that came away cleanly and suddenly. Without warning, pale bodies dropped through the ceiling, landing heavily on the tables and floor, effectively dividing the human fighters. Men and Tawa alike dropped as bullets rent their flesh.
Get down, Mercy!
The Black Beauty Hunter came out of nowhere and hurled his full weight onto Doc's back, driving him to his knees and out of the line of fire.
Pull back! Everybody! Towards the foxhole bulkhead!
The Black Beauty Hunter and his comrade stepped between Doc and three pairs of grasping sucker hands. The old man couldn't bring his sword into play. There wasn't room overhead to swing it, or space between the two big men to drive home a thrust. His tall topknot mashing against the ceiling, the black man unsheathed a knife. Not just any knife, it was a SOG desert dagger. Its 6 1/4 inch, 440A stainless double-edged blade had a blood gutter, a steel pommel, and Creighton grips. The white-painted man had an even bigger knife from the same manufacturer, a Tiger Shark model. Its heavy 9-inch blade was designed for chopping and hacking. As with the pair's mint-conditioned guns, Doc knew it was not run-of-the-mill Muti Hunter armament. In the short list of the most lusted-after pre-dark-edged treasures, these were right up there. To Doc, it seemed, the black man would no more than switch his right arm, and the belly of the beast before him suddenly came unzipped from crotch to breastbone. His partner had a much heavier touch.
Move!
As the black man turned towards Doc, another Tawa darted in and seized hold of the back of his huge bare arm. Doc could see the astonished pain in the big man's eyes. With a single chopping blow, the white Muti Hunter severed the offending hand at the wrist, leaving it hanging by its suckers from his friend's bicep.
Move it!
He shoved both his partner and Doc, hurrying them around the galley's walls. Ahead of them, the crew wielded boat hooks like spears, jabbing to hold the Tawa back while the passengers slipped through the forecastle door.
Everybody's inside! Shut the door! Don't worry. They can't get into this cabin. The deck above us is protected by the bow superstructure, and that bulkhead is 3 inches thick.
What do we do now?
We sit and wait until they decide to move on. See to your wounds and try to get some rest. For us, it's over.
The black man stared at the Tawa hand, still affixed to the back of his arm. He took hold of the stump and pulled. His ebony skin came with it, stretching from the ends of the sucker fingers.
Ah, shit!
Perhaps I can be of assistance. I have had some rudimentary medical training.
Yeah, be my guest.
As best he could, Doc examined the joint of fingertips to human flesh.
I'm going to have to cut the hand away to see how the fingers are attached to you. May I borrow your knife?
Yeah, it's all yours.
With great care, Doc filleted flesh from bone, removing all but the skin of the Tawa's fingertips. With the clammy hand out of the way, he could see the edges of the small circular wounds more closely.
It appears the suckers are lined with teeth, like the suckers of a squid or an octopus. I'm going to have to remove them from your flesh, or the wounds will become infected.
So do it!
Doc sterilized the knife point in an oil lamp flame, then proceeded to work with the tip of the blade, prying out the teeth one by one. They were embedded so deep that if simply torn free, they would have left craters in the muscle. The Muti Hunter endured the procedure in stoic silence.
There. That's the last fang. Let the wounds bleed a little, then wash them with joy juice. The alcohol will sterilize them.
Sure will. Thanks.
Think nothing of it. Here's your knife back.
Sup?
For some reason, you two gentlemen seem to have taken responsibility for my safety. Concern for the welfare of strangers is rare in the hellscape, and as such, it is always suspect. I do not require your protection. I can defend myself, I assure you. I am neither enfeebled nor addle-witted.
No one said you were.
Wouldn't you have done the same for one of us if the situation were reversed?
No.
Well, forget ulterior motives. We don't have any. This is straight business. We're looking for another fighter, an ally to help us deal with what lies ahead at the end of the voyage. Three Blackhearts always make out better than two.
Thank you very much, but I prefer to fight alone.
We have more in common than you can even imagine.
Somehow, I very much doubt that. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think I will take a bit of a nap. I did not sleep well last night.
Doc located his bunk, climbed into it, and turned his back to the cabin. He regretted there was no water to wash up with. He had to let the towel blood dry to a powdery crust on his hands, face, and hair before he could brush it off. As it dried, it itched like blazes.
Godfrey Daniels.
Doc considered how far the Muti hunters had gone to win his allegiance, if that's what they were really up to. Twice they had dragged him out of danger like a pair of overprotective mother hens. Anyone with eyes could see he was not a man of substance. Even by Deathland's miserable standards, Doc had nothing of value for the Muti hunters to steal, certainly nothing to compare with the weapons they already owned. Nor were the men cannies in disguise, looking for a bit of well-aged long pork. They had obviously passed their sputum tests with flying colors. In truth, Doc was more concerned about the downside to personal entanglement with strangers than any physical threat from his new acquaintances. His goal, and that of the other companions, was to make no ripples on the southerly voyage, to arouse no interest or suspicion. So when it came time to vanish from the passenger ranks altogether, no one would notice, until it was too late to do anything about it. Doc closed his eyes, and in familiar stages, mental stepping stones, withdrew into himself, to a dark, warm place he had created in his imagination. A refuge of memory, where his dead wife and children still lived, where he could see their sweet faces. After a few minutes of slow, deep breathing, he dozed off.
Hey, Mercy, we're underway again.
Waking, Doc could feel the boat sway as it moved. Sails that had been left unfurled and slack were evidently now filled with a freshening breeze.
Open up bulkhead, men. Carefully.
The galley beyond, though free of invaders, was a ruin. Everything not bolted down had been cast aside and smashed. Lutawa had overturned the food trays without eating anything. They had mashed and smeared most of the fried fish into the ceiling and walls. Scattered over the tables and floor were peaked circular mounds of what looked like gray-green softy serve.
What the hell is that stuff? Dude!
The white-painted Muti hunter bolted for the steps. The meaning of the odd exclamation was lost on Doc until he inhaled through his nose.
Dude, indeed!
Doc raced for the stairs, carefully skirting the minefield of squish. Doc was soon joined by other passengers in need of fresh air. He and JB caught each other's eye for a second. The armorer gave him a quick wink before thumbing his smeared spectacles back up the bridge of his nose and looking away. The sun had already broken over the eastern horizon, but it was a sickly thing, filtered, diminished by dense sulfurous clouds that tainted the entire sky. The light of day, however dim, made shockingly evident the carnage they had wrought the night before. Because so many of the Tawa bodies had been torn limb from limb, it was difficult to put a number on the enemy dead. Certainly hundreds of corpses littered the deck. It was difficult to walk without kicking a dismembered part or stepping in a blood puddle. As Aang took control of the helm, returning the ship to its original course, the islanders started examining the Tawa bodies, making sure they were dead. They worked methodically, throwing each body overboard and clearing one area at a time. After the corpses and their severed parts were disposed of, three crewmen moved in with buckets of seawater and hand brushes and began scrubbing away the residual purple goo. Among the tangled bodies, the islanders discovered three Tawa that were still alive, if barely. Gleefully, the crew dragged these wounded creatures out of the piles by their tails, pinning them to the deck by kneeling on their backs and legs. After the captives' wrists and legs were hobbled with wraps of gray tape, and their muzzles likewise sealed shut, heavy rope harnesses were slipped over their backs and secured. Doc followed with the rest of the passengers as the three Tawa were dragged to the stern. When he saw the crew attaching the ends of heavy ropes to the iron rings in the harnesses, he thought the Tawa were about to be keel-hauled. The three bound and helpless creatures were tossed off the stern, just as Doc expected. But instead of hauling, the islanders continued to pay out rope, hundreds of feet of it, uncoiling in the ship's foaming wake. The Tawa popped in and out of the gray wave tops, leaving streams of bubbles in the sea. As they popped out of the water, the heavy lines that tethered them to the stern cleat snapped taut, then went slack as they sank back. Dragged along at a fine clip, the trio of harnessed Tawa twisted and spun. The islanders were trolling them. Exactly which predators they were after wasn't clear, though they had to be big to attack a 150-pound lure.
Hey! We got one!
A fountain of foam erupted behind one of the troll baits. Then another fountain, and another. Water spraying in all directions. It looked like artillery shells falling into the sea. But shells that missed their targets, the hip-hopping lures. 50 yards behind the row of baits, V-wakes by the hundreds slashed through the wave tops, swimming much faster than the ship could sail.
So, homing in on their own.
Doc couldn't believe his eyes. If the crew had wanted to eat deep-fried Tawa, they had had plenty on the deck earlier in the morning. Why on earth would they want to recreate the same situation they had barely survived the night before? Soon, every Tawa within 50 miles was chasing the skipping baits. It was Aang who had whistled. The crowd turned to him, and he raised a hand and twirled a finger above his head. Crewmen immediately set to work on the twin racks and the red drums closest to the stern. They unlocked the rack's rear gates and, using box wrenches, removed a small hex plug from each of the first four barrels. Meanwhile, the Tawa fell upon their half-dead but enticingly jerked brethren. The troll line snapped taut again and again, strained and throwing off sprays of water as the baits were struck by heavy bodies and slashing needle teeth. With their school surrounding the hapless victims, individual Tawa were competing against each other, darting in and out, trying to chomp away the biggest chunk.
First barrel gets a 25-second fuse. Give the rest 15 seconds.
The crew quickly measured and trimmed the waterproof fuse cord to the correct lengths, fitted the fuses through special caps, and then screwed the caps into the drums.
I got it!
A moment later, the levers dropped on both racks. The first pair of red barrels lumbered down the rails and plummeted off the stern. Ryan watched them slowly sink as the ship rapidly pulled away.
Ayane!
Depth charges!
The pair of drums with shorter fuses got 150 feet upwind. The sea domed in two rapidly expanding circles of froth, 20, then 40 feet across. Towering geysers of water, foam, and smoke erupted from their centers. These plumes tossed dark chunks over a wide radius. Seconds later, having sunk deeper, the other barrels detonated. Doc could appreciate the captain's strategy. Aang had figured that the Tawa who hadn't been injured by the first explosions would instinctively drop back from the troll lines, diving away from the shockwaves, directly into the other charges. And he was right. Doc saw pale bodies and parts of Sane popping to the surface like corks in a broad swab. Blood spread in a greasy film across the gray sea. But Aang was not done, not by a long shot.
Ayane!
By the time four more cans rolled over the side, the Tawa outside the initial kill zone were drawn into the wake by the smell of gore in the water, which sent them into a killing frenzy. They greedily attacked their own struggling wounded, the large floating pieces of flesh, and each other. Through the clouds of white smoke, sundered parts pelted the sea. As the ship sailed away from the carnage, crewmen quickly hauled in the three trolling lines, their frayed and broken ends dancing through the bloody wake. Doc studied the captain's scarred face. Despite what Aang had said about revenge being an islander's pleasure, he saw no joy, no triumph in the man's eyes. No tears, either. Only grim satisfaction. A score repaid in full. Doc turned away, looking to the south, and immediately picked up something on the far horizon, something that hadn't been there 15 minutes earlier. The tiny smudge of dark purple stood alone between the gray sea and black clouds. It was the Baja. As bad a pounding as Southern California had taken on Nuke Day, Mexico's Baja Peninsula had suffered even harder punishment, not from direct nuke strikes or errant MIRVs, but from the massive geologic shifts that followed the all-out assault to the north. The Sea of Cortez no longer existed. It had been taken over by the Pacific. Of Baja's 1,000-mile length and 150-mile wide width, all that was left were its high points. For the rest of the morning, the ship rushed headlong toward the speck of land. By late afternoon, it had become a broad purple shadow on the horizon. Doc had already guessed that it was Pichacho del Diablo, Devil's Peak, the highest summit on the Baja Peninsula. 10,000 feet above sea level before Nuke Day. There was no telling how tall it was now. Its peak was hidden somewhere in the cloud bank. Because of the cloud cover, evening turned to starless, moonless night in a matter of minutes. The ship was within 3 miles of the island as darkness fell. Campfires danced along the facing shore, and rows of torches illuminated a rickety pier. Heat waves rising from vents beneath the sea filtered the light, making it shimmer and blur. From the camp, flashes of light flickered.
Was that gunfire?
Silem stood at the end of the pier, raptly watching the white ship's approach. Against the backdrop of black clouds and sea, its sails underlit by the deck lamps, it glided like a ghost into the wide, protected cove. The night wind stirred his past shoulder-length cascade of blonde curls, his pride and joy, which served to conceal a head far too high at the crown to be considered entirely normal. It looked like he was wearing a crash helmet under a wig hat. Silem's pale, fine features were compressed in the center of his face and seemed too small for the width of his head. Though fairly tall, he was cursed with a narrow chest and shoulders. To counter the less-than-manly impression this produced, he favored slightly oversized garments and broad shoulder pads. And to make doubly sure that no one got the wrong idea, he walked with a rolling, exaggeratedly masculine gait. By his own account and the accounts of the two sycophants who stood beside him on the pier, Silem was a certified genius, a poet, showman, illusionist, choreographer, scholar, spellcaster, fantasist extraordinaire. If he had lived his life before the apocalypse, those talents would have most certainly gone unrecognized. The horror show of January 21st, 2001, and its cruel, century-long aftermath had elevated Silem, as it had other unworthies, by eliminating just about all the competition. By the grace of nothing less than global annihilation, he had become Deathland's Homer, Shakespeare, and Tennyson rolled into one. Chief among his mental gifts was the ability to invent and widely circulate a great volume, if not a virtual library, of terrifying and misleading rumors. A close second was his knack for dreaming up truly horrible experiences for other people to endure. In Deathlands, there were no limits of taste or decorum, nor codes of law when it came to psychological operations. And the nightmares Silem dreamed up, Magus made real. Rish, one of the men beside him, had a big bony head and droopy-lidded, sunken, dark-circled eyes. He wore a perpetual hangdog look on his long face. From a distance, he could have almost passed for a swampy. Up close, his soft, hairless, and rather petite for an adult male, hands and feet were proof of his pure Norn blood. Rish had long ago appointed himself Silem's biographer-historian and the official keeper of the minutiae of PSYOP's continuity. It was difficult for Silem to decide on a crowning feat in a career so studded with successes. As Magus's personal mythmaker for some time, he had come up with some doozies. Magus traveling back and forth in time, that had been his idea. Magus creating the Adam and Eve of the Sticky Race, that had been his too. The list of memorable falsehoods went on and on. Magus was a fugitive from another dimension. He paid top jack for the rare muties he used in his genetic experiments. Magus was immortal. His steel fingers were everywhere at once, invisibly controlling the course of human events. He had manufactured countless doubles of himself, using spare parts from his victims. He was 1,000 years old. He had originally been the 43rd and last president of the United States of America. He had engineered Skydark. He was gathering an army of human scum to conquer all of Deathlands.
This may be your best idea by far.
Rish, you may well be right.
At least, it's certainly way up there on the list.
Oh, where would Magus be without you, Cylum?
Cylum turned and stared into Jaswinder's dark, doting eyes. The longer he stared, the balding, stubble-bearded, round-bellied man's hands twisted.
I am but the humble servant of Magus. I only follow his lead. His glory is my delight.
What a team you make. Cylum, your wisdom and art define our existence. You draw the lines even Magus must follow.
That is enough, Jaswinder.
Oh, sorry. Of course. Of course.
That Magus had the power to bring Cylum's horror shows to life didn't change the fact that they were his horror shows, the products of his imagination. Imagination was a mental facility Magus appeared to lack. If he had one, it was unrecognizable as such. Perhaps because he was no longer, technically speaking, a human, he had somehow lost touch with human fears. He relied on his hireling, his head liar, to choreograph the worst that people could do to each other. In a way, the hireling commanded the master. In a way, he had created Magus' world. Yet Cylum's accomplishments were unsigned, his genius shadowed, obscured by the legend he had so carefully constructed. But there were other, more pressing realities than public acclaim. Cylum restrained a powerful urge to look over his shoulder. One did not display hubris before Magus, nor dread, nor disgust, nor an excess of curiosity about his physical mechanical attributes, and survive. One never knew where Magus lurked, or when he was eavesdropping. Cylum couldn't see anything beyond the range of the pier's torches and the beach fires. The rock wall that abutted the cove's shoreline faded out of sight about 40 feet above the rude camps. Actually, the sheer bluff rose 10 times that height before vanishing into the perpetual cloud bank. Higher still, lost in the clouds atop the granite mountain, was Magus's lair. He only descended to sea level to savor the island's regularly scheduled entertainments. In Cylum's darkest moments, even he was unable to spin-doctor his position. His blowhard's mantra, the hidden genius, the poet, the fantasist extraordinaire, rang hollow. He was a jester to an audience of one, to a criminally insane, demonically unpredictable lord. His task was to top himself, constantly. And by succeeding in topping himself, he only made the future more difficult. If his work ever disappointed Steel Eyes, it would mean a horrible death. Magus wouldn't have to invent something for the occasion. He could use any one of the 10,000 grisly fates Cylum had devised for others. Constant creativity was the propagandist's lifeline. If the sweet juices ever stopped flowing, Magus would remove his heart and make it beat in some other chest.
Ahoy! We have arrived!
Not a soul is to leave the vessel tonight. All hands must stay on board until tomorrow morning so a proper accounting can be made. Heads and cargo must be tallied in broad daylight, or you will not be paid for your services. There will be no discussion on the matter. Do you understand?
Aye!
Locked overnight in the forecastle cabin with the other passengers, Mildred slept hard and woke up thick-headed and a little woozy. She could still taste burned cordite in her throat. She could still smell Toa blood. The gunpowder residue didn't bother her. She was plenty used to that. But she'd been drenched in the bodily fluids of a top-of-the-food-chain predator. She knew top-dog predators were where all the circulating chemical, biological, and radiological contaminants of an ecosystem ended up. There was no way of telling what infectious and parasitical agents had been floating around in that rank red mist.
Hey, time to get up.
Oof. Hungry.
Tell me about it. Even that fried fish crap sounds good right now.
I'm going to be happy to get off this ship.
Good thing, because it's looking like they're finally going to let us out of here.
Along with the other passengers, Mildred and Christy were herded by the crew up the stairs and onto the main deck. The view of the ship's stern was of an empty sea, as placid as a pond this morning. Smooth gray water blended seamlessly into a threatening gray sky, a vista without boundaries that Mildred found disorienting. The view in the other direction was little better. The island before them was all mountain, a looming pillar of granite a half mile wide that seemed to be holding up the horizon-to-horizon cloud bank. The rock glistened in the weak filtered light. Water trickled steadily down its steep walls, through its cracks and fissures, oozing from a source somewhere above the cloud line. Despite the plentiful fresh water, the only thing green was the moss on the beach rocks where tiny waves lapped and hissed. On a wide ledge above the tide line were two single-story buildings made of native rock and the sea's bounty. Scrap lumber, plastic sheeting, chunks of foam, hand-trimmed logs and branches. The larger building was long but shallow, with many doorways, like a pre-dark motel. There were no doors in the doorways, no glass in the windows. To Mildred, it screamed barracks. The smaller, even more slapdash structure had a prominent rock chimney from which black smoke plumed. It looked like a cook shack, with cooking in progress. The very thought made Mildred's stomach rumble anew. On the strip of beach below the ledge were fire pits and crude lean-tos made of piled driftwood and plastic sheeting. All were deserted. As she scanned the bluff, she caught sight of a rope handrail fixed to the rock. It marked a narrow path cut into the side of a sheer cliff. It switchbacked up 400 feet or more into clouds. The Islander crew began shoving the passengers toward the gangway and then down it onto the pier. Mildred and Christie were met at the foot of the ribbed plank by a firing squad of full-auto weapons, AKs, Galils, M16s, H&Ks. The weapons were held by 30 men in olive-drab uniforms and jungle boots. At first glance, they looked like they were from a pre-dark recruiting poster. On closer inspection, Mildred saw that most of the uniforms were threadbare. Some were stained with blood and pocked with bullet holes, the clothes of the dead inherited by the living. These armies of one had faces and hands rimed with dirt and were missing most of their teeth. When the passengers started to shuffle toward land, Mildred and Christie shuffled along with them. They moved a short distance, then everything stopped. Because of all the people milling in front of them, Mildred and Christie couldn't see the end of the line. The redhead leaned out over the pier railing to get a peek at what lay ahead. After a moment, she stepped back.
What is it?
Look for yourself.
Leaning out, Mildred saw that a temporary barrier had been set up across the pier, this to facilitate the all-important headcount. She had expected to see Captain Aang stationed at the barricade, along with the leader of the men in uniform. Aang was there with his logbook, all right. By his side was a tall, long-haired man with a shoulder-length fall of blonde curls, unarmed and obviously not a soldier with that baggy shirt and those excessively wide shoulder pads. At his elbow were two much shorter men, who gazed up at him like spellbound schoolgirls. What drew and riveted Mildred's attention was the creature standing farther along the barricade. It stood upright, but it wasn't a man. The two-legged animal was unlike anything she had ever seen or heard tell of. It had a thick, knobby, faintly greenish skin, a huge mouth, small sharp teeth, and wide-set yellowish eyes. And it was stout, with massive thighs and buttocks. A 5-foot-8-inch, 300-pound cannonball. But for the coloration and knobby topography, the withdrawn apparatus looked mammalian and very much bull-like. The creature had three-fingered hands with cruel amber talons on both thumbs and wide feet with webbed toes. Rivulets of perspiration peeled down its warty arms, over the bony protective plates on its belly, down its legs and off its pot-roast-sized testicles, pooling at its feet.
Some kind of new beauty, huh?
Mildred frowned. In her former existence, she had been a medical doctor and a researcher. She understood the mechanisms of inheritance. She knew what mutations were and how evolution worked upon them. Quite simply, the variety and strangeness of Deathland's biology fit neither the established facts nor the prevailing theories of 20th century science. Mildred knew that in nature, new species evolved only under certain conditions. First of all, the variant mutant genes had to exist in the population, and they couldn't be harmful. Members of the population possessing these genes had to be physically separated from the majority for an extended period of time. The longer the groups were separated, the more different they became. In Mildred's opinion, the differences between pre-dark and muti species were too great for the time that had elapsed. As a result, they couldn't be explained by Darwin's twin theories, natural selection and descent with modification. An alternative hypothesis, non-random and non-radiological, had only recently surfaced. Deep in the belly of the desert southwest, the companions had found living evidence that before the apocalypse, a program of ultra-secret transgenic experiments had been underway. In a hidden, high-security underground facility, whitecoats had spliced together specific genes from plants and animals and produced a new and viable organism, a distinct species, not in 10,000 years, but in a matter of months. These designer life forms were assembled with particular attributes and functions in mind. They were super survivors, living weapon systems. This black-budget military program had been underwritten to the tune of billions of dollars, despite the fact that the administration in power had branded such experimentation immoral and against God's laws, and had banned it in the public sector. Though the research program had been derailed by the events of January 21st, 2001, there was no way to gauge the post-Newcost impact of the tranny experiments because their number, their precise methodology, and their scope was unknown. But it was possible that Deathlands had been poisoned by more than just radiation.
Well, whatever it is, it should be wearing pants.
Or at least a 5-gallon bucket.
It took the better part of half an hour for them to reach the checkpoint.
Your tag numbers.
27.
28.
Yep, right here. Move along.
The blonde-haired man, not Aang, was clearly in charge. His pasty face wore a constant smirk. Mildred couldn't help but notice his misshapen skull, which bordered on the hydrocephalic. The way he carried himself, as if posing for a full-length oil portrait, reminded her of a 19th-century fop, Percy Bysshe Shelley in a too-big bowling shirt. The captain wasn't the only person with a notebook. One of the blonde man's adoring fans, the dour-faced, sunken-eyed lackey, quickly jotted down some notes, which he then offered up for his hero's approval. Mildred glanced along the barricade at the silent, staring, 300-pound guardian. It stood in a shallow puddle of its own sweat. It opened its mouth and thrust out its tongue at her, a human-looking tongue, only much longer and broader. It wasn't a gesture of contempt. She realized after a moment the thing was tasting the air, tasting whatever aroma she and Christy gave off. Its own scent was chemical, a mixture of ammonia, ether, and acetone. As it waggled its tongue, it began to perspire even more profusely. Mildred could sense the thing's murderous volatility. The gut-twisting fear she felt at that moment was instinctive, hardwired into her nervous system. She wanted to shoot it through the eye, then and there. Even the ferocious Captain Aang would not look it in the face.
What the hell is that thing?
He's a trainer.
For combat?
All recruits receive instruction upon arrival.
It can talk?
There are many other ways to communicate.
Who are you?
I am Silent. We have noted your tag numbers. You two are cleared. Pass under the barricade. Pick a campsite on the beach. You will be fed in a little while. You'll find out about the trainers later in the day.
I spotted fires around this area last night. Where do those people go?
They shipped out. Now move along.
The two women ducked under the barrier and walked toward the island. Mildred's initial question hadn't been answered to her satisfaction. Salim had told her what the creature's job was, not what it was. The transgenic weapons the companions had fought in Pueblo Canyon were simple killing automatons, following a preset biological program. If this new creature could interact on a human level, maybe it wasn't a tranny. Whatever it wasn't alone. Mildred could see a few other trainers, all of them prodigiously male, standing on the ledge in front of the barracks. They were directing the recruits away from the ramshackle building and onto the rocky beach.
Guess we don't rate first-class accommodations. They must be reserved for the boys in uniform.
She and Christy walked down the stony beach. All the campsites were in the same condition, mucky, yucky, with exposed pit toilets. Under the low driftwood eaves of the crude lean-tos, the beds were tattered sheets of plastic laid over the rocks. They chose a site as far up from the waterline as they could get. When they crawled inside, the women saw the graffiti their predecessors had carved into the underside of the roof.
Kip your blaster. Nice spelling. All lies. Ain't no army.
No army? What kind of a hellhole is this?